Thank you, everybody. Well, hello, good afternoon, and thanks again for being here. The second session in the Mind and the Cosmos series is picking up on the theme of crisis. Who can help? I'll begin with an overview of this particular session. You may remember that in the previous session, I said that the motivation for this course is the fact that nature is under threat and that our species plays a critical role in the crisis. The question I asked is who can help, and pointed out that science and religion may be unlikely candidates because they seem to be a core part of the problem, at least currently. In this session, we will move deeper into that question and explore further why science is so problematic. Specifically, we will look closely at what science has to say about consciousness and how consciousness fits into the physical world. So for the next hour or so, our guiding question will be, can we turn to science for knowledge about consciousness? Can science inform us about mind in the cosmos, what it is and where it came from? And then later on, we will see if religion may be able to help us relate to nature, to Earth, to cosmos. So let's begin with science. What does science tell us about consciousness and the cosmos? Well, science tells us that the universe began about 15 billion years ago. It began with a Big Bang, we are told, and at that time it just spewed out abundant energy. The universe was full of really very hot energy, but there was no trace of life or mind. Then about 14 billion years ago, galaxies began to form. At that point, there was lots of stars and matter in the universe, but still no life and still no mind. And then about 10 billion years after that, around 4.5 billion years ago, our solar system came into being with our family of planets, including our planet Earth, but still, according to science, no life and no mind. About 3.5 billion years ago, life on Earth appears. The first life forms were single-cell creatures like bacteria, but still no mind. So from science we learn that for those 15 billion years, there was no life anywhere in the cosmos, and certainly no consciousness anywhere in the cosmos. And so from the perspective of science, for all we know, we may be alone in the entire universe, that there may be no other intelligent beings anywhere. That's the perspective that we have from science. If we now focus on what science tells us about evolution on our own particular planet here on Earth, we have been told that life has been evolving on the planet for about 3.5 billion years, beginning with the single-celled creatures like bacteria that evolved into multicellular creatures like jellyfish, that then evolved into fish, which in turn evolved into amphibians, that evolved into reptiles and birds and mammals, but still no mind. Life, yes, mind, no. About 500 million years ago, we are told that primitive nervous systems began to evolve. And at that point, there might have been some conditioned reflexes, neural reflexes, but still no mind or consciousness. There was nobody home. The lights weren't yet on anywhere in the universe, certainly not on our planet. And then about 400 million years ago, brains evolve. And science might be willing to say, at that point, perhaps there were some primitive minds around. There was somebody home. The lights were on, but in a very, very dim way, that if there was consciousness, it was unconscious consciousness. And then about 2 million years ago, humans appear. And now for the first time, we have a neocortex that can be the seat of self-reflective awareness and true consciousness now enters the scene for the first time. And finally, there is somebody home who knows the fact, according to science. And we have named ourselves after that perception and attitude. We call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens, that we are man who knows that he knows. We are wise to the fact that we are wise. So why should this wise species develop science? Well, the purpose of science, most simply, is to know and understand the world. That's what science is about. To tell us what the world is made of and what it is doing and how it is structured. And the motivation for that, why would we want such knowledge? The simple answer, the simplest answer, is curiosity. We just want to know. And a more complex answer is prediction. We want prediction. We want to be able to tell the future. But why? Why would we want prediction? Why would we want to be able to tell the future? Because prediction leads to control. If we can predict what's going to happen, it gives us some control over what's going to happen in the natural world, control over nature. So prediction gives us control over nature. And therefore science, the purpose of science, is to serve human needs and desires. If science aims for prediction, though, in what way is it any different from an oracle? Oracles are also about prediction. Well, if we look at the definition of science, according to the American Heritage Dictionary, science is the observation, identification, description, experimental investigation, and theoretical explanation of phenomena. Well, how does that differ from an oracle? The same dictionary tells us that an oracle is an authoritative or wise statement or prediction. And according to Roget, an oracle is something that is foretold by, or as if by, supernatural means. So in some ways, science is like an oracle. Both attempt authoritative statements or predictions. Science is unlike an oracle in that oracles attempt to foretell by supernatural means, whereas science attempts to predict by natural means. That's the difference between science and an oracle. Okay, so what is science? Well, essentially it's a method. It's a method for what I call outing nature, O-U-T. It's the O is for observing. Nature is for observing the present through the senses. We use our senses to observe what's going on in the present. U for understanding the past using reason. And T for telling the future, for prediction. O-U-T. Science is for outing nature. It's actually about outmaneuvering nature by manipulating changes. It's about control. Another way of looking at science is to the scientific method is what I call the error method. E for empiricism. Science uses the senses and their technological extensions and instrumentation to get at data about the world. R for rationalism. Science analyzes data with reason and logic. R for reductionism. Science attempts to explain wholes in terms of their parts. And O for objectification. Science insists on a separation between the subject and the object, between the knower and what's known. And finally, R for replication. Science is always about repeating the experiments to attempt to falsify or to confirm the predictions. So that's the error method of science. It's about looking for a way to falsify or confirm a particular hypothesis. Now, of course, you won't find science described as the error method in any textbook. That's my own shorthand description of the scientific process. Here is something that is more familiar to scientists from the conventional traditional textbooks, that is, science is described as an experimental method for prediction by observation, looking closely and systematically at nature. By prediction, proposing falsifiable hypotheses. It's important to be able to falsify hypotheses. If you can't falsify it, then it's not scientific. So prediction by proposing a falsifiable hypothesis about some specific part of nature. It's about data collection, collecting information about that particular part of nature. Then manipulating those data to see how nature changes by controlling some specific variable. And then, of course, measurement. You quantify those changing variables to produce some objective evidence. And then you test it to see if you can confirm or falsify the results and see if they match the initial prediction or hypothesis. If they do, then you can develop a theory to explain the experimental results. At that point, you then report your findings to your peers in the community, which is called peer review. And at that point, then, they can choose to attempt to replicate your experiments by beginning the experimental process all over again. And if they do, if no further tests contradict the initial theory, it then rises to the status of a law. We have a scientific law. So science is essentially a method for discovering laws of nature. And I'd like you to remember that. That's an important point to remember, that science is about discovering laws of nature. Okay, now let's look at some of the foundational assumptions of science, beginning with what I call the three M's. Science assumes materialism, mechanism, and measurement. Materialism is the assumption that reality is ultimately composed of physical objects, that mind or consciousness, if it exists, is just an epiphenomenon. Mechanism is the assumption that all causality is physical, that all changes that happen in the world are due to energy exchanges. It's kind of a billiard ball model of the universe. The other assumption is measurement, that only what can be measured is real, that what counts is what matters to science. Now, Einstein raised a word of caution about that particular point of view. He said that not everything that can be counted counts, and not everything that counts can be counted. That's an important observation, an important caution for scientists to remember, to loosen the addiction to measurement and quantification. Some other assumptions of science are objectivity, causality, and universal laws. Objectivity has two particular meanings. There's the ontological meaning. It means that objects exist independent of mind, that the cosmos consists entirely of objects out there, beyond the mind. The second meaning of objectivity is epistemological, that knowledge, the aim of scientific knowledge is to get facts that are undistorted by subjective bias, that we don't allow our own subjective peculiarities to distort the knowledge that we get. So that's the other assumption of science and aim of science. Causality, basically the epistemological approach to objectivity is the idea and ideal of gaining knowledge of the cosmos as it is in itself, uncontaminated by human consciousness, or any consciousness, effectively. The assumption of causality is that every effect is the result of some prior cause, and that all causes are physical, involving exchanges of energy. And if that's the case, there can be no non-physical causes. The final assumption I'm going to look at today is the assumption of universal laws, that nature is governed by laws, and that all laws are ultimately grounded in physics, and that scientific laws hold universally. There can be no exceptions. That's what a law means. It holds universally, and there cannot be any exceptions to it. So science's ultimate ideal is laws. Science is effectively a law-making enterprise. In the philosophy of science, it's called nomothetic. Science is nomothetic. It's law-making. It seeks laws that are objective, independent of mind, quantifiable, that can be expressed mathematically, and that are universal, that they are the same everywhere in the cosmos. So a law of science will hold not just on Earth, it will hold in the Pleiades, or Andromeda. But laws aren't particular to any particular region of the universe. So science's ultimate ideal, therefore, is to discover laws of the universe by knowing all the physical causes, to be able to predict all the inevitable effects. This would be the ultimate ideal of science. The ideal result would be complete control of nature. Now, expressed that way, it sounds a little grandiose and perhaps even pathological. But we need to recognize that even though I believe that is the underlying aim of science, that science, that approach has delivered some very useful benefits to humankind along the way. Control science has been very successful. It has yielded highly sophisticated technologies, for example, in agriculture, that to help feed our growing populations, in medicine and sanitation to help fight against diseases, in architecture for housing our increasingly centralized and growing populations, in communications to speed the spread of education and commerce, in industry to help feed the insatiable appetite for perpetual progress. Now, we have gained all of this and a lot more from the scientific mastery of matter. But there's just one little problem, and it's this: consciousness. The problem, effectively, is that, like oil and water, consciousness and laws just do not mix. Let's take that step by step. Given the nomothetic ideal in science, that all causes are governed by laws, that all laws are objective, quantifiable, and universal, and then, on top of that, given the metaphysical assumption of materialism, that all causes are physical, then it follows that consciousness cannot exist. Consciousness is non-physical, non-objective, and non-measurable. Therefore, scientific causality must exclude consciousness. It has no other option. At best, consciousness or mind is epiphenomenal. And consciousness, therefore, what that means is consciousness cannot be causal. It can have no potency, which means that volition, free will, self-agency, or choice must be an illusion. However, if consciousness were causal, choices would affect the behavior of matter. Right? If consciousness can have causes in the universe, it means that consciousness and choices can affect the behavior of matter. So that would mean something other than physical causes would interrupt the flow of events. And if that's the case, there could be no scientific laws. You cannot have consciousness and laws in the same universe, because laws would no longer be universal. If some conscious choice can step into the process and interrupt the flow of events, then it means that you cannot have laws that are universal, and that means that precise prediction would be impossible. So instead of laws, scientific laws, we would have to have scientific habits, habits of nature. Once we acknowledge that there is consciousness in the cosmos, that nature has a mind of its own, then scientific laws have to go out the window, and we have to recognize that what we are dealing with are habits of nature. And there may be some very, very strong habits of nature, like gravity, that looks like a law, but actually it's just a very, very deeply ingrained habit. It can change, like our own psychological habits can change. Effectively, it is a psychological habit. It's a cosmological, psychological habit. That's what a law is. Now, the scientific ideal, as I said, is to arrive at laws that are true everywhere. And what that means, it goes hand in hand with the ideal of objectivity, of having no viewpoint at all. The ideal is to deal with the world without any subjects. Because if you have subjects, you have consciousness, and if you have consciousness, you have choice, and if you have choice, you cannot have scientific laws. Laws are wholly objective descriptions of a universe composed entirely of objects. And a world composed entirely, in other words, it's a world composed entirely of external its, what the grammarian would call its, as opposed to I's or you's. Science cannot cope with first-person I's or second-person you's. In other words, it cannot cope with subjects, with beings that know. It cannot cope with knowers. And that is a deep paradox for science. It really puts science in a very awkward dilemma. Here's why. Since all knowledge, including science, requires experiencing subjects or consciousness, therefore modern science consists of knowledge without knowers. In a world full of objects, science would be impossible. If it was nothing else but objects, you could not have any science. But that would be absurd, right? So to avoid that absurdity of knowledge without a knower, science had to create a gap between the knower and the known. As a methodology, that really isn't so bad, and it has worked very well as long as we were dealing with the exclusively objective universe. It produced all those technologies I mentioned a moment ago. It allowed science to study nature without having to worry about mind or consciousness. But the subject-object split was just a convenience. It was a methodological, epistemological convenience. And it's something that science soon forgot, apparently. What it did was it elevated an epistemological maneuver into an ontological principle. Basically, what happened was this, that science moved from a statement, all we want to know about are objects in the world, which is epistemological objectivity, to all the world contains are objects, which is ontological objectivity. And I consider this to be a clear case of very convenient amnesia, that science forgot that it only began with the subject-object split as an epistemological, methodological maneuver, and it then turned to actually establishing that as an ontological principle, saying that this is the way reality is. And that leads to what I call plate glass science, that objectivity assumes a gap between subjects and objects. Science views nature as though it were behind some thick plate glass window. Nature, apparently, from this perspective, is remote. It's a detached other. It's out there beyond the knower. The scientist, presumably, is a detached, remote observer, separated from the object by this thick plate glass. And this works more or less until science focuses on mind or consciousness. Clearly, this approach of plate glass science cannot work for the mind. As soon as we turn the beam of inquiry back on the very instrument of inquiry itself, then clearly you cannot have that separation between subject and object. Now the object of inquiry is the subject doing the inquiry itself. So detached observation becomes impossible when we come to study consciousness or the mind. Now we're dealing with consciousness studying itself. So let me just summarize the position that the criteria for the standard plate glass science are these: objectivity for observation, measurement or quantification for precision and certainty, mechanism for explanation, prediction for control, and the underlying motivation for science is control. And I'm proposing that there's an even deeper underlying motivation for science, which is fear of losing control of nature. Now, I have had many conversations, indeed even arguments and debates with other philosophers and scientists about this, and I've been criticized for presuming or suggesting, proposing that there is this deep underlying fear of losing control motivating science. They tell me, no, that really the motivation for science is curiosity. And I'm not denying that many philosophers and scientists are motivated by a deep curiosity to know how the world works and how we fit into the world. But in addition to curiosity, I still am pretty convinced that beneath that, if we get beneath the curiosity, there is a deeper fear that's motivating science. And here's why I think that. That if we go with, if we start with, as science does, with the metaphysical assumption of materialism, that nature or the cosmos is intrinsically insentient, without purpose or meaning, and that evolution is the result of accumulated random accidents, and that what survives is the fittest, that survival goes to the fittest, and the fittest are those who reproduce most successfully. Think about it. Reproduction means turning matter into living flesh, turning the matter of the planet into living flesh. If we reproduce ourselves, it comes down to us turning some portion of our planet into human flesh. That's what reproduction means. And anything that disrupts the conversion of matter into human flesh threatens human population growth. Humans have the intellectual might and the right, apparently, from this perspective, to secure maximum acreage for human consumption. But nature doesn't share that view. Nature is either indifferent or hostile to the idea of human privilege, that humans somehow have the right to turn the planet into more human flesh. Nature doesn't share that assumption. And since nature doesn't share the assumption, we need to tame the wild beast of nature if it's not going to align itself with us. And we then have a science that attempts to help us outmaneuver nature so we can tame it and turn more of nature into human flesh. We outmaneuver it, as I said a moment ago, by observing the present, understanding the past, and telling or predicting the future. All of this is achieved by manipulation and control. So, in a nutshell, the basis of all of this is that science gives us human-centered technologies at the expense of the rest of nature. And there's an assumption there that we have the right to do that. Well, what would give us the right? According to scientific materialism, it's because matter is dead, dumb, and sentient stuff. It is mindless. And consciousness emerges from brains. That only creatures with brains have intelligence. We live in a brain-centric culture. That the only intelligence that exists is where brains exist. And humans have highly developed neocortices. And that's what gives us our self-reflective intelligence. And that allows us to understand and control nature. And only humans, therefore, can outmaneuver nature. And that's why we are special. Well, do we have the right? Let's examine that logic a little bit more closely. According to this worldview, humans are special because we have superior intelligence. Our superior intelligence is produced by our highly complex brains made of matter. And matter is nothing but insentient objective energy. And that's all there is. There is nothing else in the universe, according to materialism. The core metaphysical assumption of materialism is that nothing else exists except matter or physical energy. But if that's the case, it cannot account for consciousness. And without consciousness, there is no possibility of science. Yet science exists. Therefore, consciousness must exist. That's the logic. If science exists, consciousness must exist. You cannot have science without consciousness. Therefore, materialism must be flawed or incomplete. And if materialism is flawed because it cannot account for consciousness, then perhaps we don't live in an indifferent or hostile or unfeeling cosmos. Consciousness, in fact, in this case, then would come from something other than insentient dead matter. It would come from, in fact, sentient experiential matter, matter that feels. And in that case, we would be surrounded by a natural world brimful of sentience and consciousness. And I'm proposing that we cannot, despite our lofty aspirations, that we cannot outmaneuver nature, because our intelligence itself is rooted in the deep intelligence of nature. Our own intelligence is actually an expression of the intelligence of the cosmos. The presence of consciousness in nature, of course, does not automatically guarantee fairness and balance. All we need to do is to pay attention to human consciousness. Just because consciousness exists doesn't mean that everything's going to be fine. Consciousness can choose to go either way, towards benefit or towards evil. Consciousness has that choice. So just the fact that consciousness exists in nature doesn't guarantee us that there will be fairness and balance. We may still need to protect ourselves from other creatures and from the vagaries of nature, indeed even from other humans. However, with consciousness comes purpose and meaning, and we can be open to learning from nature by participating with it, rather than by attempting to control it. And that's the main point of this, is that if consciousness exists in nature, not just in human brains, then we can learn from nature by participating with it, rather than by controlling it. That leads to a different kind of science. We may learn to communicate with other intelligences in nature and thereby learn to trust nature instead of fearing it. So that leads to a different kind of science. It includes the exploration of consciousness as well as the exploration of matter. It would be a science of mind as well as a science of the physical world. It would be a science that explores subjects, as well as objects. It will be a science that moves beyond the myth of objectivity to include subjectivity and intersubjectivity. It will be a science that employs different ways of knowing beyond the senses and reason, including intuition, feeling, transrational ways of knowing, and non-sensory ways of knowing. So instead of plate glass science in this new science, we get looking glass science. Instead of objectivity for observation, we will have subjectivity for observation and participation. Instead of measurement and quantification for precision, we will have engagement and quality for subtle discernment. In the new science, instead of mechanism for explanation, we will have meaning for understanding. Instead of prediction for control, we would have a science that aims at growth towards transformation. And instead of control being the underlying motivation, we would have transformation itself being the underlying motivation of a science of consciousness. And the deep motivation, instead of being fear of losing control of nature, would be trust in nature's process. That's the new kind of science that we will need if we're going to have a science of consciousness. So let me just summarize the comparisons there between plate glass science and looking glass science. Plate glass science aims for objectivity. Looking glass science aims for subjectivity. Plate glass science aims for measurement and quantity. Looking glass science aims for engagement and quality. Plate glass science aims for mechanism. Looking glass science aims for meaning. Plate glass science aims for prediction. Looking glass science aims for growth. The underlying motivation of plate glass science is control. The underlying motivation of looking glass science is transformation. And the deep motivation of plate glass science is fear, compared with the deep motivation in looking glass science of trust. Very, very different approach to understanding nature and having knowledge of the world that we live in. So given that, we can now go back to the original question of how science can help. It can help by changing its foundational story of materialism from an ontology of dead matter to one where matter now tingles with experience, that matter actually tingles with the spark of spirit, by recognizing that there is mind in nature, that consciousness goes all the way down, that consciousness is everywhere in nature, by acknowledging the obvious potency of consciousness. We all know that consciousness is causal. We all know that consciousness is potency. That's what gets us out of the bed in the morning. We make a choice to get up, and we get up. The body follows the choice that consciousness makes. So we know that consciousness is causal. Science can help by giving up the brain-centric dogma of epiphenomenal consciousness. It can help by acknowledging the sacredness of all nature, that nature is intrinsically holy, that nature is imbued with spirit. It can help by radically changing the way science is done, by adopting a radical epistemology that honors other ways of knowing, such as intuition and feeling, and by adopting these new guiding criteria, especially when studying consciousness. Okay, so now having looked closely at science and why it is unlikely to help us unless it changes, I'd like now to also, and why science clarify the relationship between humans, nature, and the cosmos. Science will need to change if science is going to help clarify how we fit into the cosmos in a way that accounts for consciousness. I'd like to now turn back to the problem of religion and see if religion can help us. Again, I'll turn to the American Heritage Dictionary for its definition of religion. According to the dictionary, religion is belief in and reverence for a supernatural power or powers regarded as creator and governor of the universe. In other words, God is supernatural, transcendent, remote, other. It focuses our attention elsewhere on an afterlife. Now, I have to preface what I'm about to say by acknowledging that many of the thumbnails I'm about to give are simplified generalizations. I don't have time to go into these religions in any great depth or detail. particularly about the monotheistic religions. And I have to acknowledge that there are many varieties of religion, that each religion has many subtle variations in beliefs. But with some exceptions, all of them focus our attention on human spiritual welfare and salvation. That's what religion is primarily about, is human welfare and salvation. Some exceptions to this include indigenous religions and some forms of Taoism and Buddhism. However, to the extent that any religion singles out human souls for divine attention, it privileges our species and contributes to the split between nature, between humans, and the rest of the natural world. Let's just briefly look at the mainstream religions. Judaism, for example, has us believe in a deity called Yahweh as the creator of the world. It focuses less on an afterlife, more on the coming of a future Messiah. The Genesis story emphasizes man's dominion over nature, and the focus is on a historically chosen people. For its part, Christianity has a God that is transcendent, yet historically incarnate. It emphasizes caritas, or human love. The ultimate focus is on heaven in the afterlife, and it tends to regard the body or the flesh as sinful, and that includes the human body and the body of the natural world. In Islam, Allah is utterly transcendent, and the focus is on getting a reward in paradise in the afterlife. Compare that with some of the polytheistic religions, like Hinduism, for example. In Hinduism, there are multiple gods, and they are all unified under the ultimate Brahman. Nature is considered maya or illusion, although that still doesn't exclude respect for nature, but ultimately is considered maya or illusion. Buddhism, for its part, is essentially a non-theistic psycho-spiritual therapy religion, and in its purest form, aims to avoid any metaphysical speculation. Buddhism urges liberation from the wheel of samsara, and it honors all sentient beings. Taoism has two forms. There's religious Taoism that is full of ancestral gods and nature spirits, and then philosophical Taoism, which has a deep reverence for nature. In general, conventional religious doctrines do not teach us to look for meaning and spiritual guidance in the natural world. Many religions say we are special by divine fiat, that God gave us souls so we may survive and transcend the inevitable corruption of the flesh. Thank you. Human souls, we are told, are separate from the body, from the human body, from the earth body, and the body of the cosmos. Well, I'd now like to look at that in closer detail. Perhaps the human soul is far more intimately connected to nature and cosmos than conventional religions would have us suppose. For instance, what if our experience of spirituality, of the religious impulse, is rooted in the very essence of the cosmos itself? Behind the multiplicity of religious forms, the drive toward religious expression is grounded in a feeling, an experience of mystery. This mystery is the feeling of wonderment at the relationship between humans and the greater forces of the cosmos. In the face of cosmic immensities and overwhelming forces of nature, the human response has been a feeling of awe, fear, mystery, and reverence, the experience of the numinous. According to the philosopher of religion, Rudolf Otto, the sense of the holy always contains an element of fear, what he called a mysterium tremendum. However, it is always accompanied by an element of fascination or awe, a mysterium fascinorum, fascinosum. In either case, the common factor is a feeling of mystery. This, then, is where we need to look for the roots of the religious impulse, is this feeling of mystery. Well, how far back in the evolution of species can we meaningfully trace this impulse? We know that some other mammals, such as elephants and gorillas, for example, exhibit behavior suggestive of a sense of mystery when confronted with death, with the death of their kin. And we know that other animals do exhibit emotions such as fear, anger, sexual desire, and in some cases, sadness and joy. However, we have little comparable data to suggest that non-human animals engage in cognitive processes approaching the complexities of human cognition. So the sense of mystery, then, at the root of the religious impulse, is a felt mystery rather than some cognitive working out, rather than some cognitive puzzlement. We can trace the religious impulse, therefore, to a feeling, to a particular kind of feeling, a feeling of mystery. And if we are to determine how far back along the evolutionary line the religious impulse originates, we would need to know more about the relationship between feeling and mystery. In other words, not only must we decide where experience or consciousness begins in the great unfolding of evolution, we must also decide where a particular type of experience, the feeling of mystery, originates. If, for instance, we assume that all organisms, no matter how primitive, have a capacity for some kind of feeling or experience, would this mean that all such organisms also have a capacity for experiencing mystery? Well, perhaps the capacity for bare feeling comes first, and that a more evolved capacity is required to experience the sense of mystery. But it could be the other way. It could be that what we call the religious experience, the sense of the mysterious, has its roots in an evolutionary continuum, stretching all the way back to the ability of primitive organisms to feel out the probability patterns that underlie actuality. Whenever the gap between actuality and possibility is felt or experienced by an organism, it may experience a sort of proto-sense of mystery. According to the philosophy of panpsychism, nature's ultimate constituents are, in fact, organisms with consciousness. Even single cells, molecules, atoms, electrons, protons, and photons have some degree of experience. Experience, therefore, would be ontologically primary, an integral and intrinsic ingredient of the entire cosmos. And in that case, the potential for religious experience is a feature of the cosmos itself throughout space and time at all levels of actuality. In some sense, the cosmos may be pervaded by a feeling of mystery, awed and fascinated by the difference between its own actuality and its felt possibilities, between what is and what might be or what might have been. This new religion that recognizes that the religious impulse is something that transcends just humans recognizes that the entire cosmos itself is holy because spirit is present everywhere throughout nature, all the way down and all the way up. God, therefore, is not above nature. God is not supernatural. God is intrinsic to nature. And the sacred is all around us. The path to the sacred is not only through priests and churches and rabbis and synagogues and mullahs and mosques. We can experience the sacred anywhere in nature, by gazing at the stars, by watching a sunset, by playing with animals, walking through a forest or on a beach, climbing a mountain, digging in the garden or planting flowers, filling our lungs with fresh air, dancing through crackling autumn leaves, embracing a loved one, or holding the hand of a dying parent. The most direct way to the divine, I'm proposing, is by touching and feeling the earth and its inhabitants. Being open to the spirit, to spirit in ordinary as well as extraordinary events. The way to meaning, therefore, is by reconnecting with the world of nature through exuberant participation and or through the stillness of meditation. by just being present and listening with our whole bodies and being. And when we do, we learn that we are not alone, that we are not uniquely special, that we share this magnificent planet and cosmos with countless billions of fellow sentient beings. And as we saw earlier in the previous session, that this new religion is actually a very ancient wisdom common to indigenous peoples throughout the world and throughout history, and that it has been called pantheism, that God is nature and nature is God. And in philosophy, it's called panpsychism, that mind or spirit exists everywhere throughout nature. So the solution I'm proposing is a new story that takes us beyond conventional science and religion, where science and religion take a broader view of how humans fit into nature, by giving up the story that humans are special, by recognizing that all of nature is ensouled, that matter itself tingles with the spark of spirit. And I was talking about the performative contradiction in relation to the first session. It applies to the worldview of idealism, which is basically a religious perspective on the cosmos, a spiritual perspective on the cosmos. And in idealism, the perspective, the idea is that matter is just an illusion. And I gave a critique of that, saying that we don't actually live in the world in a way consistent with the claim that matter is an illusion, and that we cannot live in the world in a way that's consistent with that claim for a very good reason. That if we try to live in the world as though matter is an illusion, we end up being very bruised at best, and we don't survive very long at worst. We have to treat matter as though it's real, otherwise we don't survive. And so that is the critique of spiritual idealism, of the spiritual perspective. Now, in using philosophy to address spiritual issues, we have to be very careful. We have to realize that philosophy is always dealing with language, dealing with concepts, dealing with as far as reason can take us. But one of the beauties, one of the gifts of reason, is that reason can recognize that reason is not the end game as far as epistemology is concerned, is that there are other ways of knowing beyond reason, that reason is a form of knowing that can take us to the edge of reason and say this far and no further with reason. But that doesn't mean that there isn't any knowledge beyond reason. It just means that if there is, reason cannot access it. And it certainly doesn't mean that the limits of reason mark the limits of reality. That would be the ultimate in hubris and arrogance, to say just because we cannot conceive it doesn't mean it isn't real. So now acknowledging that there are other ways of knowing that transcend reason, it means that if the main objective of philosophy is to come up with a coherent explanation and coherent understanding in language about how the world is put together, about how we as human beings fit into the world, and if it then, by using the rules of logic and coherence, we find out that the spiritual idealist perspective encounters this performative contradiction, that it encounters, in the case of the Maya hypothesis, or there's another version of idealism, which is emanationism, which says that the world begins with pure spirit, and then pure spirit, in a kind of step-down transformer process, creates denser and denser versions of itself until it, at the bottom level, it creates the dense form of matter. And so that's the emanationist view of idealism. The problem from the philosophical perspective of that version of idealism is that it is really just the mirror image of materialism. Materialism says we begin with purely, wholly objective reality, and then we end up with reality that is no longer wholly objective, that now has experiencing subjects. Well, the emanationist, and that's the emergentist materialist position, the emanationist idealist position flips that over and says, no, you begin with pure subjectivity, with pure spirit, that then, through this step-down process, creates real matter. Well, how do you get real objective matter that's really real, that's not an illusion, that really is real, out of stuff that didn't have the slightest trace of matter to begin with? that would require a miracle just as much as materialism would. How can you get from one state of reality where there isn't the slightest trace of objectivity or physicality to a state of reality where now there is some matter, where there is some real physical stuff? Well, the only way that would happen logically and coherently is that if we said that the world didn't begin with pure spirit, that there had to be some trace of materiality or some trace of physicality in spirit to begin with. But that's not the way the religious traditions or the spiritual traditions describe idealism. They say, no, it begins with pure spirit. Well, if you begin with pure spirit, then logically you cannot ever get out of that. You're locked into that. You cannot get out of that into a world that is now has real matter or energy. So that form of idealism encounters the same kind of logical problem that materialism encounters. Okay, from the perspective of philosophy, from logic. But remember, reason can take us to the edge of reason, where reason can go no further. Once reason takes us to the edge, we then have the option of moving beyond reason to see whatever else might be the case. Now, I can speak from my own personal experience and say that I've had experiences that do not fit within my own logical understanding. I've had experiences where reason cannot coherently describe the experiences that I've had. For example, I've had experiences in some shamanic work that I've done where I've had the experience that time, past, present, and future all exist in the present moment. I have no way of coherently understanding that within the domain of philosophy, within the domain of reason. There's no way that reason can coherently account for the collapsing of past, present, and future into a single moment. We cannot talk about that. But it doesn't mean it isn't real. And so as I present the critique of the various worldviews of dualism, materialism, and idealism, and propose panpsychism as the most coherent alternative to these, I'm on the one hand saying that as a philosopher, this is the most likely story. I love what Plato said near his death. In fact, some stories say on his deathbed. He turned around to his students and he said, "Everything that I have written, everything that I have said, is nothing more than a likely story." And in some ways, that's all that philosophy is. It's a likely story. And so as a philosopher, I'm looking for what is the most likely story to account for the relationship between consciousness and the physical world. And the most likely story that holds together for me, that doesn't have any internal contradictions, is the worldview of panpsychism. That's true for me as a philosopher. Now, to the degree that I step outside the rigors of philosophy and engage in other ways of knowing, like shamanic ways of knowing, shamanic practices, then I'm relating to reality in a very different way with a different set of criteria. And I don't need for the world to conform to my rational, coherent categories. In fact, I've had experiences, as I said a moment ago, that cannot be encapsulated within my rational, coherent categories. So I'm open to the possibility that there, and I will address this in a later session, that there may be truth in dualism, there may be truth in materialism, even materialism, there may be truth in both forms of idealism, the Maya idealism that matter is an illusion, and the emanationist form of idealism, and there may be truth in panpsychism. They may all be true. In fact, in one of my non-philosophical experiences, I've had the crystal clear realization that they are all true, that everything is true, and everything and its opposite is true. Absolute clarity about that. I have no way of dealing with that within my world as a philosopher. I don't know how to talk about everything being true and its opposite also being true in a way that makes coherent sense. and yet I can have the experience, profound experience, that that is the case. So what I'm saying is that we need to make the distinction that philosophy is always dealing in the domain of reason and logic, in the domain of language. That is the philosopher's gift. It is the gift of reason. And in a later session, we will be looking at the other gifts, the gifts of the shaman and the gifts of the mystic. And when we examine those gifts, we realize that what they reveal for us about the universe is very, very different from what we know about the universe from the perspective of philosophy. But it comes down to this. If we want to talk about the world, if we want to talk about consciousness, if we want to think and talk about the relationship between consciousness and the physical universe, then we are automatically already in the domain of the philosopher. And we are then required to have coherence in our thinking and in our talking, to the extent that we can, to the extent that thinking and talking can take us to describe what's going on in the universe. So we need to honor the philosopher's gift of reason while recognizing that there are other epistemological gifts, there are other ways of knowing. But that doesn't mean, on the one hand, either that the philosophical way of knowing is the ultimate, or that it needs to find a way to fit in with the shamanic or the mystical way of knowing. There is no requirement that philosophy, which approaches an understanding of the world through reason and logic, should be compatible with an experience that transcends logic and reason. If we are going to think and talk about consciousness, as I said, then we need to honor the philosopher's gift of reason and be as rigorous as we can in looking for a coherent understanding and explanation of what's going on in the world, recognizing that there may be experiences that transcend our reason and logic. As well as the course that I teach here at the University of Philosophical Research, I also teach courses at John F. Kennedy University in consciousness studies. And I begin every class that I teach by letting my students know that what we are about to embark on is an exploration about consciousness rather than an exploration into consciousness. That in thinking and talking and writing about consciousness, that's not the same as having the direct experience of consciousness. But since this is an academic institution, what we will be doing will be thinking and talking and writing about consciousness. However, to remind the students that always we need to pay attention to the direct experience. And so I always begin every session with some moments of silence, encouraging the students to recognize that ultimately the fish that we're trying to catch here is not something that can be caught in the net of language, that language and concepts cannot capture consciousness. We can talk about consciousness, but talking about consciousness is not the same as experiencing consciousness. And that the more I explore consciousness and its relationship to the physical world, the more I'm convinced that by far the best medium for investigating consciousness is to zip up, is to drop into silence. That's probably a good place to end.